This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, October 4th, 2012. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, 100 Years of Poetry. Harriet Monroe published the first issue of Poetry Magazine 100 years ago, this October. In the issue were poems by William Vaughan Moody, Emilia Stewart Lorimer, Helen Dudley, Grace Hazard Conkling, Arthur Davison Fick, and another fellow by the name of Ezra Pound. The first poem in a new anthology called The Open Door, 100 Poems, 100 Years of Poetry Magazine, is a very short and very famous one by Ezra Pound. Chris, would you do the honors and read that poem?
In a station of the metro, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough.
In a station of the metro, as vivid as it is short, Christian Wyman is the editor of Poetry Magazine, and he edited the anthology with Don Scher, the senior editor of Poetry. Chris and Don, it was to be expected that the first poem in the anthology would be something by Ezra Pound, but the second poem comes as a surprise. It's a Kay Ryan poem called Shark's Teeth. Don, can you read that one for us?
Everything contains some silence. Noise gets its zest from the small shark's tooth-shaped fragments of rest angled in it. An hour of city holds maybe a minute of these remnants of a time when silence reigned, compact and dangerous as a shark. Sometimes a bit of a tail or fin can still be sensed in parks.
That was Kay Ryan's Shark's Teeth. Tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I think it's basically reminding us that our safe, noisy, civilized life is ultimately built upon an alien primordial world, which we get glimpses of now and again. Is that a fair reading of the poem, Don?
I couldn't put it better. No, I think that's really it.
It's a little ambiguous, though, because the shark's teeth are at once sharp and potentially dangerous, and yet they also are our only possibility for rest. You know, Pascal has that famous quote about all the world's problems would go away if we could just learn to sit in a room in silence for an hour by ourselves. And this poem is, in a way, about the very thing that we all crave and yet fear, is that moment of silence.
Huh. I hadn't read it that way. Yeah, that's interesting. Now, as the editors, what are you saying by putting the Pound poem next to the Kay Ryan poem?
Well, in a sense, they kind of bookend the whole century. In Pound's very small poem, the faces in the crowd swim up at us. Mm-hmm. It was the first real imagist poem that anybody really remembers. And so it takes that image of urban life, but it connects it with nature. Mm. The petals on a wet black bough are the last thing maybe in our commutes we would think of. Mm-hmm. But I think it is a distant relation of Kay Ryan's poem, because in her poem, we still have that sense of nature and crowds, and Pound's poem is very silent, it seems to me. One of the striking things about it is there are no voices. You don't hear murmuring voices in a big crowd. And Kay Ryan says, an hour of city holds maybe a minute of these remnants of a time when silence reigned. So it's almost a kind of evolutionary movement from one poem to the next one.
Unconscious tribute, almost. We found that you could read a lot of these poems in light of Ezra Pound. You could see that sharp, imagistic cut of In a Station of the Metro making way for a whole bunch of poems later in the century, even as late as 100 years later. Hmm. So modernism hasn't played out completely.
I read the anthology over the weekend, and one of the great pleasures was I never knew what was going to be on the next page. Can you explain what you're up to when you place poems written decades apart by very different poets next to each other?
Oh, we were thinking of two things. We wanted the experience to be akin to reading the magazine, so that you open the magazine and you see all these different styles coexisting and also colliding with each other. And also there's an anthology that was published years ago called The Rattle Bag, and there was an update of it called The School Bag, edited by Seamus Heaney and Ted Hughes, which Don and I both love. And I was actually just read it again recently, and it's an incredible anthology. And all it is their favorite poems crammed together in ways that they want people to read them and ways that they think will be provocative. And you can turn page after page after page, and you keep getting these little flares going off in your brain, and you know that these are just poems that those two people loved. And that's what Donna, we just went through and found the poems that we loved and then carefully put it together in ways that we thought would be striking for readers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of kind of an eccentric art collection of
like, yeah,
that's pretty like good. It's like, yeah, each one's hanging on the wall, right?
Yeah, like the Barnes collection in Philadelphia, the famous collection where he insisted on placing certain paintings next to each other.
Right, I would have been happy to take the names off if they had let us.
You know what else? I think that's the way people read poems. You know, within a few years of the founding of Poetry Magazine, Eliot had written an essay, Tradition and the Individual Talent. And really, he came up with this idea that art and works of literature, they really are juxtaposed, that they kind of exist together, and that when we look over our shoulder, they're the ghosts of all these artworks and pieces of writing, and that they're all sort of in a continuum, but they're not. It's not exactly linear, that they do coexist, and they are juxtaposed, and that's what we have to deal with. So it's a kind of reading that was possibly invented at around the time Poetry Magazine was. I mean, we expect juxtaposition now, but it wasn't always, you know,
right,
the given mode.
I'm going to ask each of you to pick out a poem that you think will surprised you that it's in this anthology, first of all, and that you think will also surprise readers. Chris, do you want to go first? Do you want to pick out something that you can tell us about and read for us?
I got one.
What are you thinking?
Charles Bukowski.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was surprised to see this, and I was surprised to see the poetry ever published Charles Bukowski and to begin with. But tell us a little bit about the poem and then give it a read, if you would.
All right. So this, I was surprised. I am not a great admirer of Charles Bukowski, or at least thought I wasn't. I didn't know that he'd been in Poetry Magazine, and he was published by Joe Parisi in 1993, and I really liked this poem. It's no Great Shakes formally. It's a quick, funny, sharp poem, but it stuck with me. It's called A Not-So-Good Night in the San Pedro of the World. It's unlikely that a decent poem is in me tonight, and I understand that this is strictly my problem and of no interest to you, that I sit here listening to a man playing a piano on a radio, and it's bad piano, both the playing and the composition, and again, this is of no interest to you, as one of my cats, a beautiful white with strange markings, sleeps in the bathroom. I have no idea of what would be of interest to you, but I doubt that you would be of interest to me, so don't get superior. In fact, come to think of it, you can kiss my ass. I continue to listen to the piano. This will not be a memorable night in my life or yours. Let us celebrate the stupidity of our endurance. As I say in the intro, I had a moment when I wanted to actually title the anthology, Let Us Celebrate the Stupidity of Our Endurance, but not everyone shared that suicidal sense of irony, as I say it. You know, this is a funny poem, and a lot of these poems that we published have a kind of a funny edge to them, which was, I mean, a great relief to us going through all these. We wanted that in the anthology as well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Don, how about you? Is there something in the in the anthology that you're surprised is in there?
Yeah, I think we were both surprised by a Tom Dish poem from 1972 called The Prisoners of War. September 1972, Poetry Magazine had an anti-war issue devoted to the Vietnam War. Not everybody signed on to, you know, assent to that, and it had a very funereal cover, and it was a statement, you know. And I think most of us are generally aware of anti-war poetry and the kind of stuff that is in anthologies. And this poem really, to my knowledge, has not been in an anthology. And I think, surprised us because it uses the language we use today, but it wouldn't have been common at the time, as you'll see. Mm-hmm. So this is Tom Dish, The Prisoners of War. Their language disappeared a year or so after the landscape. So what can they do now but point at parts of bodies, at what they want to eat, at instrument panels, at new highways and other areas of intense reconstruction, at our own children smiling into cameras, at the lettering on canisters, at streaks of green and purple, at the moon, at moments that may still suggest such concepts as civilization or justice or terror, and at ourselves, those still alive, who stand before what might have been a year ago a door. I mean, the images and language there are right out of, everyday news stories now. I don't think it was very common in 1972 to look at war in terms of this vocabulary of civilization and justice and terror. Those are words that we use now. And even the images that seem in the poem that seem familiar to us from what we see around the world today shows that Dish really envisions something tragic but vivid about war and its effects on people every day.
And that last image, who stand before what might have been a year ago a door, the way I read that was that there may have been another path other than war. You could have opened a different door, and if we didn't go and invade Iraq or something like that. Is that how you read that? How do you read that?
You know, I never read it that way. I actually see it as an image of destruction, of people's homes in ruins.
Oh, so there's only a door remaining.
Yeah. You know, a portal that now goes nowhere and leads to no home or no business or no school because it's been bombed into rubble and people are trying to live in the middle of debris.
Uh-huh. Also, the words themselves have lost their capacity to let us into them. They're closed off to us, and so we can't understand. Their language disappeared a year or so after their landscape. And so those things were doors, and now they are no longer, they offer no access, civilization or justice.
He's giving language to people who in the monumental experience of their tragedy are close to speechless, or at least whose voices are not heard in the larger scheme of politics and decision-making and, you know, planning for war.
It's a very odd conception that people could lose their language, or that their language disappeared entirely.
Yeah, the clear paradox is that people do lose their language when everything else is taken away from them and their reference points and ways of living are gone and have been destroyed. And it's the poem that gives any kind of language to this. Hmm. Their language disappeared, but he has language.
But it's not just a people that have suffered war. It's our language because he talks about the at our own children smiling into cameras, at the lettering on canisters. So this is, it's we who have been destroyed by the war. Yeah. Our language has been destroyed.
Yeah.
In a later podcast, we'll hear Don Scher and Christian Wyman read and talk about more poems from their anthology, The Open Door, 100 Poems, 100 Years of Poetry Magazine. It just came out this month from the University of Chicago Press. In the meantime, you can start making your own personal anthology from the thousands of poems up on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.